The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Well, this advisory committee to the FDA just taking a vote for Pfizer's vaccine for ages 5 to 11. A lot of the advisors were asking if the recommendation could perhaps be narrowed to more at-risk kids. There was a lot of debate over the benefit risk because of the unknown risk of myocarditis, that heart-related side effect that has been seen predominantly among young men after the second dose of mRNA vaccines. This is a third of the dose of the adult vaccine, so there was a lot of debate over whether there will be much of this seen in the younger kids population. So now this goes to the FDA to make its decision. After that, it will go to a CDC committee next week to make recommendations on how this vaccine should be used. And we'll see if they agree that this should be potentially narrowed to more at-risk kids.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's big news, huh? That is great news, I think, for some parents, and it is horrifying news for others. Vaccine advisors to the FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, they voted unanimously. It was 17 to nothing. There was one abstention. And they recommended the emergency use authorization of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for kids 5 to 11. Look, you're the parent. If you got a kid in that demographic, it's up to you to make that decision. Members of the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, they agreed that the benefit of vaccinating younger children outweighed the risks. And as you heard in that report there, Pfizer has cut its vaccine to about a third of the adult dose for children under 12. And they did clinical trials, and the trials showed that the lower dose protected children against symptomatic infection. And the hope is that it will cause fewer side effects. This is a conversation for really another day, because we could drill down into it. Do kids 5 to 11 need the shot? Apparently, FDA says yes, and Pfizer says it's effective. We do know that the infection rate for kids is much, much lower, and the infections that they get are not as great. But that's the latest news. So, you know, from age 5 on up, Pfizer has vaccines available. And, of course, booster shots are out for Moderna and J&J and Pfizer as well. So are we on the back end of the pandemic? Maybe we'll talk about that in the days ahead. We've done a lot of pandemic talk lately. Do want to get into something else. Kevin Turley is going to be joining me in a moment here. We're in this time of year where there's greater occult activity. And throughout the show today, Kevin Turley will stop. I want to talk about horror movies. Is it okay to watch horror movies? You may love them. And there are two perspectives on this. Some people say you shouldn't brush up against that type of evil, shouldn't entertain it, you should not glorify it. I would agree with that. Then there's the other side, too, that says, you know, these horror films, in some respects, really exemplify the power of Christ over evil. So often when they demonstrate how good conquers evil, The Exorcist and The Conjuring and a lot of these other type of movies. So we'll stop. We'll talk about that a little bit. Feel free to join me anytime. The number here is 888-914-9149. Then we'll also talk about haunted homes. There's an exorcist in D.C. that says he sees a surge in demonic activity now. It's on the rise, and this is happening universally. It's not just here in the States. Rome, there's a call for greater exorcist and really throughout the world. And then I'll share with you, you know, one of my favorite, you know, Halloween type stories I had. I interviewed a man who ran for politics and was not Catholic, and he bought a home, and there was some bizarre activity that was taking place in that home, and he called in shamans and all sorts of other people to get rid of it. Did nothing until they called in the priest. What happened in that home is eye-opening. It's a great conversation for you to listen to. We'll get to that a little bit later. We got a lot to get into. That's just some of today's broadcast, but feel free to dial in anytime. The number, as you know, 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. So as we get closer to the celebration of All Hallows Eve, you know, you see a lot of horror stuff around. And stores, of course. Look, this has become a second Christmas almost. And I don't mean that in the spiritual sense. I mean it in terms of the financial sense. I mean, there's so much money spent on Halloween, the parties, the decorations. People decorate their home as much for Halloween, in some cases they do for Christmas. Stores, you know, they put out these ugly witches. The new thing this year, I've been seeing a lot of these spiders crawling down these giant webs, you know, kind of cool looking. And then there's the TV, the movie theaters, right? There's all kinds of horror movies being shown in theaters. It Chapter 2 is really big right now. Adam's Family. You walk into a big box store like Walmart, and they're being sold all throughout the store. But horror films, let's talk about that for a moment. They're all over the place, right? I mean, there are classics that you might remember, like Dracula, right, and Frankenstein. You know, as a kid, if you watched those, you might have been terrified. Today, you look back at them, they're pretty tame compared to the horror films that you see today. And there's some, you know, you've got all sorts of them, from Freddy Krueger to Jason to Friday the 13th to The Exorcist to The Conjuring. I mean, you name it, lots of different movies out there. Some of those are just gore. They don't really scare me as much as some of those demonic ones do. And personally, I don't like horror movies. I don't like them. But there are 13 different sub-genres to horror films. It's not just, oh, horror, right? There's 13 different sub-genres to that whole horror film genre. And the one that's really dominant today, I never really got this, but it's the zombie film. People love the zombie film. A lot of people say that they like that genre because it gives them a good scare, but, you know, there might be something more to it than that. I'm joined right now by a filmmaker, a writer, a journalist, a script writer, a radio presenter, a great friend of this show. He just came out with a brand new book. It's called This Thing of Darkness. And it's great to have him here with me today. Kevin Turley joins us. Hey, Kevin, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Good to be with you.
Good evening to you over in England there. I know it's a little bit later, so it's great to have you with me. Congratulations on your latest work. I hope it's doing really well. Tell me a little bit about it before we get into the conversation. Fill everyone in on what The Thing of Darkness is all about.
Okay, it's published by Ignatius Press. It's Hollywood 1956. We have an English journalist and war widow called Evangeline Kilhooley, who's assigned to write a star profile of the fading actor Bela Lugosi, who was made famous by the role of Count Dracula in the 1930s. During a series of interviews, Lugosi draws Evie into his curious Eastern European background, gradually revealing the links between the old world shadows and the twilight realm of modern horror films. And along the way, Evie meets another English expatriate called Hugo Radel, a movie buff who offers to help her with her research. But as their relationship deepens, Evie begins to suspect that he knows more about her and her late soldier husband who was killed in Korea than Hugo is letting on. Meanwhile, a menacing darkness, that's with a capital D, stalks all three characters as their histories and destinies mysteriously begin to intertwine.
Yeah, sounds awesome. Sounds like a great read, especially this time of year.
I think so.
That's good. And Ignatius, and if anyone wants it, you know, go to ignatiuspress.com or go ahead and just do a search for it. Kevin Turley, the book is This Thing of Darkness. No, that sounds great. It sounds like it's a page-turner for you. And I like the premise of the novel. It's kind of an interview with the aging actor, right, with Lugosi, who played Dracula, as you point out, in the 30s. Other than that film, and I'm curious about what happened to him, he didn't seem to succeed much. My producer and I were talking about this morning. And when he mentioned names, you know who Bela Lugosi is? I said, oh, yeah, sure, he played Dracula, right? That's about all I know of this guy. Did he get typecast into horror films in the genre? What happened to him, and, you know, what kind of influence did these have on his life?
Well, that's a really good question. And in some ways, Drew, that was what drew me to initially start to concoct a fictional story around this, because you're absolutely right. The 1931 Dracula, which he starred in, overnight he had this huge success and is still synonymous with the role of Dracula. Before that, he had been a quite a serious actor in Hungary, where he was from, and he'd also worked in the German cinema. And he was, you know, he was doing Shakespeare. He was a proper actor type thing. So doing Dracula was just another role that he thought he would do and, you know, leave it behind and go and do something else. Right. But success is a way, as you probably know, of trapping people. And by the 1930s, he was kind of mired in these never-ending horror films, which were factory films, a lot of them. You know, the production standards were decreasing as the decade wore on. The stories were getting more ridiculous. His characters were essentially a one-note play on the Dracula figure. And, you know, by the 1940s, he was working in sort of poverty row films in Hollywood. And then you know, it was a sort of descent after that. I mean, it was a steep ascent as Dracula, and then an equally steep descent after that. And by the mid 50s, he was very much washed up. He had had various drug problems. I think he had four wives. He was, you know, he was a man who had seen better days, and that's the moment in the fictional book. And I have to say, this is not a biography or a memoir about Bela Lugosi. It's a fictional right. take on the whole thing. That Evie comes across him, and really, what we have then is two unreliable narrators, one of whom's looking back on a life, but maybe with a secret, because success comes at a price. But the question then is, who are you paying for that success?
Yeah, it's a great point. My guest today, Kevin Turley. If you want to join us, our number here, 888-914-9149. Yeah, I'm torn on the whole horror movie thing. I used to love them when I was younger. I used to watch it all the time. And some of these don't scare you. They're just gore. You know, they shock you. I mean, the ones that scare me sometimes have that spiritual underpinning to them. And there's two mindsets when it comes to horror films. I mean, should a Catholic entertain this particular genre? And I like your take on that. The one thought is, you know, we don't want to glorify evil. We don't want to entertain it. We don't want to brush up again. We don't want that spiritual grit on us. The other thought is, you know, in movies like The Exorcist or The Conjuring or a lot of these other, even the Dracula series, I mean, good always conquers evil. And that really speaks volumes also about our faith and the victory of Christ. There's nothing wrong with a good scare. Everybody likes it. What do they do to our minds? And what do you think they do to our souls? I mean, how do you view this particular genre?
Well, I think the genre needs to be viewed in the light of cinema in general. And, I mean, you know, the last time we were chatting about how cinema had a certain restraint. We had the production code. Certain things were not allowed to be shown on screen or not even allowed to be talked about. And, I mean, you know, the first thing to say is that that the horror genre is as old as cinema itself. I mean, there were horror films in the 1890s. The first Frankenstein was in 1910. You know, the 1920s German cinema, which was probably the best technically and artistically in the world, was absolutely saturated with occult themes and occult films like Nosferatu, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, etc. And then by the 1930s, a lot of the German emigres, they go to Hollywood and they start making occult films there, but it's more Dracula, Frankenstein, and so on. By the time I started watching them, we had had this sort of British revival with Hammer horrors and so forth in the 1960s. And then 1968, Rosemary's Baby is the game changer because it moves horror from a kind of jokey subgenre almost to the mainstream. And I would say that Rosemary's Baby is a very sinister film in lots of ways. And then you have films like The Exorcist and The Omen. And then after that, you have a sort of a battery of slasher or stroke, which I'm not quite sure if they're horror or sort of crime or what are they, but it starts to break up a little bit. And what also is breaking up in our society, though, is an understanding of what is good and what is evil.
Yeah.
So to sort of answer your question rather indirectly, Drew, I think that there are many representations of evil, and I think in horror films, at least it's quite blatant.
Yeah.
What really horrifies me more and makes me very annoyed is when you have more subtle propaganda, especially aimed at children in Hollywood films, which is promoting a worldview which is not Christian, an anthropology which is not Christian. And that sort of thing is more hidden. I have a lower tolerance for that sort of thing. I think an awful lot of films today, they're exploitative. They play to the basest desires of human being, and I'm talking about a lot of mainstream films. But I think what also we're seeing today is that Hollywood has run out of ideas, and this is true of the horror genre, like a lot of genres. It makes endless sequels and remakes, and it tries to just kind of pad things out. And part of the problem is that Hollywood is dominated by ideologies and philosophies, which won't allow that certain things are evil and that good must triumph, and it won't even tell you what good is. So I think we're living in very confused times, and we tend to get the cinema that we live in. It reflects the society we live in. So I think the horror genre in some ways is now defunct in a sense, because the real horrors, I mean, if you think about it, we're talking about vampires, which don't exist, right? And we're talking about other things that don't exist. But in, you know, in London today, I mean, there are many so-called clinics operating where there's a true horror show going on, where innocent, you know, children in the womb are being murdered straight away. So that's a real horror show going on. So society has lost its moorings, I think, and that's reflected in the cinema around us.
I know, I totally agree, and I share your view on, and I say it to my wife all the time, you look at shows that you would watch decades ago, and now they're even using the same title. I mean, why not just change characters and change the title? You take a look at Hawaii Five-0, or if you take a look at the CSI series here in this country, how many versions of that do they have? You know, there is a certain regurgitation of material that's out there. And you're right about the horror films, and we see the same thing. But what is it about Hollywood? I mean, what's your sense on it? Do things ebb and flow? Are we just at a particular moment where these are super popular, or are we now entering an era where, you know, we're going to gravitate away from them? I mean, Hollywood seems to have a fascination with this particular genre. Maybe people just like to be scared. Maybe it's the time of year. I don't know. Is this going to be a perpetual thing, or do you think that some of these things have a cyclical nature to them?
Yeah, I mean, if we were honest, I think we both agree. I love a good ghost story, you know. And you love a good film, which, if it's done tastefully, you know, is sort of a bit of a shock and so on. But I guess part of the issue for Christians is that you come to a certain point where you watch films and you suddenly realize that, like anything in life, you have to ask yourself, is this entertainment, is this thing moving me closer to Christ, or is it moving me away from Christ? And, you know, in the past, I'd have to say that horror films, you know, because the use of the cross or holy water or so on and so forth, you know, you could sort of say, well, you know, good triumphs, and it triumphs because of the truth of the Christian message, so forth. Today, I think the vast majority of Hollywood's output, I just can't identify with the thinking and the philosophy behind it. It's just not consistent with the gospel. So I'd, even if it's frightening on one level, it doesn't quite work. And I think a lot of your audience, and probably you and I, that's where we get to, where this isn't just an innocent entertainment. This is something, you know, we're also facilitating the studio system or Netflix or whatever, where there's an agenda which isn't Christian. So it's become very political on many, many different levels. And I think the fun has gone out of it. Because the other thing I will say about the devil, one of the things that the saints and the church fathers have written and so forth, is that the devil can't create anything. He's a counterfeiter, right? He's good at sort of aping the gifts and the creations of God. So in some ways, the horror genre, you know, is a bit like that. You know, if it doesn't have goodness and truth at its center and triumphing, then I'm afraid it's always going to be a pale shadow of what it should be.
That's so true. My guest today, Kevin Turley, and talking a little bit about watching horror films, he wrote a book, just came out. You can get it at Ignatius Press. It's called This Thing of Darkness. And he takes a look at the extraordinary life of Bela Lugosi. Your book, very quickly, let me circle back to that if I could for just a second. How do you think that's going to do? What's the appetite for something like that today in our culture? And what motivated you to write? There's a lot of stuff you could write about. And you're a very gifted journalist and writer. What was it about that? And what kind of appetite is there out there?
Well, the first thing to say, Drew, is co-written. It's co-written with Fiorella De Maria. I always liked a good spooky tale, but the thing about the horror genre is, first of all, I think Catholics should be writing in every genre, because every genre is manipulated by people with philosophies and ideas, and what we've done is we've taken the horror genre and we have infused it with a lot of Catholic ideas. And the thing, I mean, you started talking about Halloween, and I mean, a lot of Christians, and I share it, have a lot of concerns about the occult imagery and paraphernalia around at the moment, especially a city like London. The shops are full of that sort of broomsticks and cats and witches and all that sort of stuff. But I remember I was interviewing an exorcist once, and it was around about the time of Halloween. And I said to him, you know, what do you think of this? Expecting him to say, isn't it terrible? And he said, no, I actually think there's a positive to this. And I said, well, tell me more. And he said, well, in Britain today, the secular, agnostic, atheistic Britain, at least people are starting to think about something supernatural,
wow,
something beyond the rational. So, I mean, the other thing is that I hope the book is picked up by Catholics and enjoyed by Catholics, and I stand by it as a very Catholic read.
Yeah.
But maybe it will also touch the hearts and souls of people that aren't Catholic but like the genre and are curious about the supernatural. And therefore, it's a way in which you can talk about good and evil and themes like the communion of saints and other things. But you have to do it in an entertaining way and a way which attracts people where they're at, not where we'd like them to be. I mean, the book is not written for cloistered nuns, unfortunately. They don't need it.
I love it. That's what my broadcast is about. We need to speak in a language people understand and be where they are today if we want to draw them closer to the Lord. Let's see. Sneak a quick call in. I know you got to run here. Let me get Joseph in Chicago on. He's got a message for you. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Thank you for your work, Drew. Jonathan Turley, this interview has just been enlightening and inspiring. Thank you for it. I wanted to share something and then pose a question, if I may. The sharing is the fact that in 1990, that was the last year I went to a theater because I had become so disgusted with the moral corruption of Hollywood's productions in the most part. So I instead turned to wholesome things at Turner Classic or reading books, classics in particular, to get entertainment that didn't pollute my mind and soul. And I'm so glad to hear you mentioning, your description of Hollywood. So my question for you is Hollywood moving in a direction that is got some promise for a more wholesome and more spiritual view of the world without only darkness and evil? And is that even happening in the fiction author community?
Yeah, great question, Joe.
Thanks, Joe. That is a good question. It's a huge question, though, Joe. It's probably a whole show on its own. I think the thing that changed, the game changer in Hollywood was The Passion of the Christ. That made so much money, and that's the only thing that really matters in Hollywood, that people started saying, wait a minute, there's a constituency out there that wants to see very much faith-based films which are completely down the line. So there's been, I mean, we had the Fatima film a couple of years ago or last year, and we've had other sort of manifestations of that. I think at the end of the day, Hollywood is a reflection of society, and I think it's a reflection of the world we're in, and I think Christians must not abdicate their responsibility to take part in that and to try to do their best in it. But, I mean, having worked in that world myself, I'm under absolutely no illusions that that's a huge mountain to climb.
Yeah,
but I think we've got to try. But also, I'm kind of curious, and I think Relevant Radio is part of this. I think that we've come to such a toxicity in our society and cultures that maybe Catholicism and Catholics have to set up alternative media. So we need our own TV stations, we need our own radio stations, and maybe we need our own literature and our own entertainment because it is so polluted out there. I mean, it is so toxic, a lot of the stuff that's on offer. So I think we need both. I think we need to infiltrate the other side, but I think as well we need to be more confident that we have the truth and that we are sharing the truth and that we're actually... I mean, at the end of the day, Drew, you asked me how the book was going to go on that. If this book brings one soul closer to Christ, we've succeeded.
That's succeeded.
The rest is immaterial.
Amen to that. Well, Jonathan, always a delight having you here. I appreciate your intelligence and your eloquence, and I wish you the very best. The book is called This Thing of Darkness. It's written by K.V. Turley. That's Kevin Turley. Published by Ignatius Press. You can check it out there or do a search for it. I'm sure it'll come up. Last name is Turley. Stay with me when we come back from from horror movies. We'll talk haunted homes. Stay with me. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny. I saw, read a story actually about a Maryland couple who said, we ain't ghosts. They discovered they unwittingly, They actually bought a house, which inspired the story of The Exorcist. So let me ask you a question. If you know that somebody was murdered in a home, would you buy the home? If you knew that there were ghosts in that home, would you buy the home if you thought it was haunted? You say, I'm not afraid of ghosts, right? What if there was an exorcism that was done in that home? Would you buy that home? True story here. There was a Maryland couple learned that the reason they got such a good deal, they bought a home, right? It was the home of their dreams. They couldn't believe it, right? They found this place in Cottage City, Maryland. It was going really cheap, $377,000 for them. It was $50,000 lower than the estimated value on the property. They thought, this is great, right? The buyers ended up buying this place, and they found out later it was the very home that a Catholic priest performed an exorcism on a teenage boy. That boy would inspire a book and ultimately the movie that you might have seen called The Exorcists. And during this was a very competitive housing market, right? A couple couldn't believe they got such a great deal in it. It's only a 3-bedroom place. They learned the truth after the house closed. Now, I think you have to disclose if somebody died in the home, but what if there was an exorcism? Probably not, right? In 1949, there was a Catholic priest that arrived at this house to perform the ritual of exorcism. And what ended up happening was strange things took place in the room. And you know the story, right? The story of the exorcism was not about a girl. It was actually about a boy. The true story was about a boy. And his aunt would come over, and she would end up playing, play the Ouija board with him. And that's a portal. That's a doorway. That opens the doorway to evil. And a lot of exorcists say that that's been a tremendous portal for possession for a lot of people. During the very rare exorcism ceremony, witnesses who were there, they witnessed furniture sliding across the floor, and then the teen yelling and cursing in Latin. He was shouting out these Latin phrases. As the priest shouted, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, I cast you out. They're doing their thing. All of a sudden, he's screaming in Latin at him. So the couple gets the house. They're not afraid of the home's history. And says, I was knowledgeable about the occult and about demons, but we're not worried about this place, right? Now, what worried me, I had heard that once they found out about the place, they have some friends, right? And the friends said to them, hey, why don't you get a Ouija board and, we can have a little seance here. And the family, thank God, the friends offered to bring the Ouija board over and recreate the scenes from the movie. The couple declined, and I think that was smart. Who knows what would happen? The last time somebody played with a Ouija board, the couple said, they made a movie about the home. So couples in the house, once it's exercised, I don't know if I wouldn't have any reservation about it. We know the authority of the church, the power of the church, the authority it has over evil. But still, I don't know if I knew about it ahead of time. Do I want a home with some sort of spiritual disturbances in it? Probably not. The couple apparently is embracing the home's history, and they are... They're getting ready for Halloween. And this is unfortunate. Say a prayer for them. Because one person says, I'm thinking of getting a Catholic priest Halloween costume this year and get a speaker and have the Exorcist soundtrack playing on it in a loop on the front porch for trick-or-treaters. They might think that's funny, but I still don't think it's a great idea. So, there you have it. I don't know what's going on in your home or what it's like all over the country this time of year. There are houses that charge people to go through them. And so, patrons could be scared. A lot of times it's just that. You just get scared, right? It's a fright. Although, you got to be careful. Sometimes there's a lot of demonic imagery. There's even stuff read from the Satanic Bible and things that are in some of those soundtracks that are out. And, I'm not a huge fan of it. Haunted houses are creeping up all over the place right now. And you might say, hey, this weekend, let's go to one. Or, hey, I don't know. I'm always a little cautious about it. There are some people who live in houses that are really haunted. There are disturbances. You might remember the story from a few years ago. Remember the house in the Diocese of Gary, Indiana, where there were some really strange things going on? really strange things. So strange that even child services and police, they chalked it up to something otherworldly. They could not have been of this world. Now, I don't want to scare anyone. If you've got kids, you might want to turn the radio down just for a minute, because this is kind of, it's creepy. In this particular case, a 9-year-old boy walked backwards up a wall in the presence of the family case manager there and the hospital nurse. And of course, they freaked them out, right? They would hear footsteps on the stairs in the middle of the night. Nobody was there. You know what's really weird? Two flies. You know, you see that in the Amityville Horror story, but I thought that was just Hollywood. Apparently, there were tons of flies in the wintertime. Eventually, an exorcist was called in. And after four attempts, you know, it's not always one and done. You just come in and say a few prayers. Sometimes exorcisms take a while. It took about four attempts, and that took care of the problem. But after some documentary filmmakers did a film about it, the home was ultimately demolished. And I am joined right now by Father Michael Maginot. He's the pastor of St. Stephen's Martyr Parish in Merrillville, Indiana. He's the priest that conducted the exorcisms that eventually led and freed Latoya Amon of Gary, Indiana, from possession and her rented house from haunting. He joins us this afternoon. Good to have you with me today, Father. Thanks for being here.
Okay, sure, Drew. Thank you.
Delighted. Hey, I was just sharing a story. I know you weren't on, you weren't connected to me at the time. I had read a story about the house in Maryland where a 14-year-old boy had been possessed, and that story would ultimately, you know, become, you know, the book and the movie, The Exorcist. And of course, the home was exorcised, and the child was ultimately liberated and freed. Another young couple bought the home at a really depressed price because of its history. And I'm just curious, from your perspective, once the home is exorcised or the person is liberated, that home is as safe and as free as any other home, right? So these people are kind of right by moving in and taking advantage of the deal. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you have to see what the source of the problem is. So a demon can attach to a person, a place, or a thing. And so you do have to determine what is the source of the demonic attachment.
So that's, you know, it's an interesting comment you made, Father. Expand on it. A demon can attach to a person. We understand that. And I'm sure it manifests in all sorts of ways, from everything from illness to possession, right? Anxiety, depression, all sorts of different things could have spiritual roots. And I want to be careful about how I'm saying this. Then secondly, the home, we know places can be haunted, graveyards, places where trauma or evil or seances have taken place. But objects, I'm fascinated by that. You know, explain that. I just remember years ago, and I'll share a true story. My parents bought an antique bed set. It was put into the room next to mine when I was a kid, right? It dated back to 1700s or beyond. In the middle of the night, I'd hear the handles of this bureau come up and then just drop. Go up, and at first it terrified me. And after a while, I got used to hearing the noise, and I'd say, "Come on, I'm trying to sleep," or I didn't let it bother me. It was just a disturbance. It could have been a purgatorial soul, you know, trying to get my attention for prayer, and I did offer prayers, or it could have been something more. Explain what happens to an attachment. And I'm sure objects can be cursed and things along those lines. Explain that if you can.
Yes. So usually it involves some sort of ritualized action on a part of a human being to do that. So they would have to make kind of an agreement between them and a demon to attach themselves to some object. And usually the object would have to, a demon to accept attachment to an object, that it would never be thrown away. And so that it will be always kind of esteemed or be around. But now, naturally, a demon will attach to an object to get to a human being. And so that's their ultimate goal. They just don't want to be attached to places or objects. Right. They want to get it eventually to a human being and take possession. But they know if a person gets attached to an object, then they could work on getting into the person as well. And so a place oftentimes it is where rituals like I would say serious rituals and it could be, you know, even just doing seances and things, but it actually a lot of times it's much more sacrificial in nature. You know, there's altars involved and things like that. So a place that had something that severe done, you know, it actually can open what we call a portal that, you know, demons could kind of come and go, you know, because, you know, as long as the person invites that in, they're accessible.
You were involved in the exorcism of a home that was later destroyed, ultimately, and some bizarre things happened. I won't go through them all, but you know, you faced that. The authority of the church came through. That was in Gary, right? Diocese of Gary, Indiana. I think also of another famous place, Amityville. And I'm just wondering about those really, you know, having a disturbance in your home. Maybe there's a spirit of anger. Maybe there's a spirit of division. Maybe there's an addiction. Maybe objects move. Maybe there's specter, like, you know, it's all across the spectrum. But places like Amityville or the one in Gary, they seem to be really extreme. I don't know whether Amity was built on over an Indian burial ground, as some claim. Explain that to us too. Why are certain places more destructive? I don't know, more active than others is probably the word I'm looking for.
Well, definitely the Indian burial ground is a very dangerous place because you're disturbing, you know, Indians who tend to be pagan. You know, so they're. You know, there's a lot of ritualistic, they do kind of go to war, you know, because their gods tend to be demons, you know, so they will attack, not holding their buried souls, you know, their buried bodies sacred, you know. So, and if you do any cemetery, you know, kind of disturb the graves of any cemetery, you're kind of stirring up, you know, souls that may not be at rest. And so it's kind of a common thing that you're desecrating what should be sacred. And so you're kind of inviting disturbances there. They may be human or they may be, you know, demonic too. But usually, but if it's something that, you know, an actual witchcraft and Satanism and, you know, involving, you know, sacrifices, you know, of various things, you know, animals and things, so, you know, if they've been done in a area, that can be an open portal, you know, of that. If it's not closed up, it's open. And now usually the way to close it up is, it's kind of simple. It's first of all, getting someone who is not a Satanist to buy the house, you know, and then bless the house to seal it up. And I often find that if that's still not enough, even Benedictine medals in the four lowest points in the house corners seals it, that whatever, nothing can come you know, through there with that. So that seems to make it, you know, but you have to own it, you know. And that's the unfortunate thing with the Gary house got torn down, because the original plan was for me to, you know, seal it once the, you know, documentary was done. You know, I was kind of intentionally leaving it open so he could document everything. But the time before we were going to do all that, it attacked his crew, which he kind of, you know, he would like to not protect himself. And I, you know, and when I was kind of in the house, I had protection. Right. I had Benedictine crucifixes, and I gave them to the camera crews. They all had their own protections, different blessed objects, you know, wearing. But he didn't want that. And he was actually getting ready to wrap up the documentary. So he wanted to document what activity was in there. But the people that weren't protected got attacked. And he got attacked. And it actually stopped me from going in, because the doctor that was going to measure after I did the cleansing and, you know, and sealing and binding and all that, he got sick. The cameraman went crazy, you know, and he went kind of, he got affected with his eyesight, and it disrupted. He never called me, and he went back, you know, back to Las Vegas, and, and said he was going to do that later. But then the next thing I found out, he tore the whole place down. And so he left it open. And so that I never.
Father, hold that thought, though, because I've got to take a short break. Okay. When we come back, we can pick it up. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking to Father Maginot. He did the exorcism on LaToya Amond, and the home, which had, it had demonic presence in it. It was ultimately, he's referring to Zach Baggins, who is the producer of a ghost show for the Travel Channel. And apparently, as you just heard, his crew, unprotected, was both attacked, and many were made sick. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about haunted homes today. When we come back, Father, maybe we can address whether or not we should go through haunted homes, whether we should decorate our home for Halloween. And I'll take some calls. I only have a few moments with Father today. So if you want to get in, here's how you do it. It's 888-914-9149. We're back with more right after this.
The power of Christ compels you.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. It's Halloween week. Have a question about ghosts, cults, or demonic possession? You'll get some real Catholic answers right here. It's Halloween week. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, it's that time of year, and I thought it'd be good to just take a look at some things to do and not to do. And I'm not a big fan of entertaining evil, glorifying it, or opening the door to it. I think that is just going to bring a lot of heartache to you. But it does raise questions. Is it okay to do things like decorate your house for Halloween? Is it okay to go through a haunted home? And I'm not necessarily saying one like the one in Amityville or in Gary that are truly possessed. Although there are a lot of people who go to graveyards, they try to conjure, they try to have seances this time of year. So I thought it'd be important to bring some clarity to these issues. Also, coming up later in the broadcast, I want to share with you a great conversation I had. And there was a book written about this as well. It's called The Demon on Brownsville Road. It's an amazing story of another haunted home. So you'll enjoy that story a little bit later. But I'm joined right now by Father Michael Maginot, pastor St. Stephen Martyr Parish in Merrillville, Indiana. And he has conducted exorcisms that have led to the freedom for LaToya Amond of Gary, Indiana, from possession, and the home there that was haunted, and some bizarre things took place there. Father, before we take any calls, let me ask you a question. And if you want to get in, we only have a few minutes. The number here is 888-914-9149. I'll do my best to get you on the air. Is it okay to decorate one's home for Halloween? I guess it depends on how you decorate and what you put in it, right? Some people go pretty far. Is there any danger in that?
Yeah, I think I kind of like when I was a kid, you know, it was the jack-o'-lanterns and the, you know, maybe the skeleton, you know, the cardboard skeletons and, you know, just bats and, you know, different things like that in the window. And I think that was all nice and fun, but some places kind of get a little bit, you know, look like graveyards and, you know, a little bit too much, too macabre for me. So it's,
does that draw any sort of negativity? Does it draw negativity or evil to the home?
I don't think, you know, that will do that, but it kind of leads to probably further things, you know, so that maybe the person who makes their house like a graveyard may be tempted to go to an actual graveyard and start doing conjuring, you know, necromancy and rituals, right, and things like that. It's like a gateway to get to the real things that are dangerous. What kind of is the problem is getting kind of obsessed with that, and then, you know, that curiosity usually kills the cat, and that's when it's because that's an invite, is just being curious about something, right, can invite some, you know, have you go deeper, especially with access on the internet of all kinds of things. Yeah, you could go down that wrong road very quickly.
People during this time, you like to have seances, try to conjure the dead, or play with Ouija boards, mm-hmm, to communicate with spirits.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Those are absolute no-nos, right?
Yes. Those are definitely not fun and games.
Yeah, no, it's the real deal. I mean, you are literally, and Satan's, mm-hmm, a legalist, giving him the opportunity, mm-hmm, to communicate with you and attach. So,
that's his goal.
Yeah, so be careful this time of year. Do not entertain that at all. So let me ask you one more thing, then we'll grab a call or two for you. The haunted homes. You know, there's some that are set up, and they're just, you know, people jump out and they scare, mm-hmm, or mice run on the floor or whatever. You know, okay, that's, mm-hmm, just spooky. That just gives you a jump and a fright. Mm-hmm. Some of these places, mm-hmm, though, you see they have pentagrams, or they think it's harmless, but they might be reading from the Satanic Bible or playing some really, mm-hmm, dark, evil-sounding music. How do you discern that? Mm-hmm. And should people go through haunted homes that might have disturbances, whether it's something that's set up for money or whether it's the home down the street that has been abandoned and supposedly, mm-hmm, is haunted?
Definitely when you get into I would watch anything that's realistically a ritual. So, any reading from Satanic Bibles to pentagrams, they're definitely, that is most common with, you know, candles and things, too. It's a ritual that will open up a portal. So that is very real. And I know when I was, young priest, you know, around this time, I was in charge of the youth group. So we did go to a forbidden forest, it was called, you know. It was a big line of people and such. Right. And it was outdoors. And, you just had different things jump out and, you know, you know, make people scream and such. So I think that was, it just harmless fun. And a similar thing we had, went to the next year to a place called the Haunted Mansion, you know. And it was the same type of thing, but it was indoors. And then we went on a hayride, and then there's a local road here that called Reeder Road, and you know, and mm-hmm. and the kids were, you know, it was, to me, I think it was just kind of things to do for teenagers and kind of fun. Yeah, they were pretty noisy. Nothing really realistically happened there. It was just, and you know, it's mainly bonfires and afterwards and things like that. So,
well, let me do this, Father, because time is really short. We'll grab a couple calls here if we could before I pray the chapel. Rose is in California. She's listening to us. She's got a question for you. Hi, Rose.
Okay.
Hi, Drew. I have a family member struggling with schizophrenia, and I'm wondering, you know, we use medication, but she responds to, you know, saying the rosary and different things. I'm just wondering if there's anything more we can do to alleviate her struggles.
That's a great question. In this respect, Father, let me clarify that. You know, how do we discern, you know, legitimate mental illness or psychological problem from something that might be, demonically influenced? And what can we do?
If the medications are helping, and things like that. Schizophrenia is very serious. So if the medications do seem to help and such, it does seem to be a mental illness. Yeah, but I usually kind of do tests, you know, so involving, is there reactions to putting religious objects on them, or reading a passage from certain passages from the Bible that seems to, you know, agitate spirits within them. If they kind of react to something that, we also have them drinking regular water or holy water. So there's this little test. If they tell the difference between the, they react to the holy water, but not to the regular water. So there's just certain things like that that they don't really know. I'm probably giving out my bag of tricks, but they're usually, if they're schizophrenic, they're not going to react to those things.
Right,
they would just be kind of bored. They'd just be listening to something and kind of falling asleep, you know, if it's not. But if there is a spirit attached to them, yeah, then it agitates the spirit, which agitates them.
Rose, thank you for your call. We're going to pray the chaplet right now, so I'll remember that intention along with my personal ones. We'll pray in particular for those who struggle. Father, thank you for being here with us. If someone is having real spiritual problems in homes or within their family, best thing, I'm assuming, just call the diocese for some help?
Yes, definitely a house blessing and I, as I mentioned, if you could get a priest to bless for Benedictine medals, it even helps for any, you know, types of haunting within a house.
Right. Father, I got to leave it right there. Thank you for being here. We're going to pray the chaplet when I return. Stay with me.